Okay, hi. I think we're going to start right now. It's a few minutes later than I thought, but it's all right still. My name is Tilman Frosch. I'm going to speak on the topic of e-mobility as a privacy game changer. And about me, I'm a researcher at the Horst Götz Institute for IT Security in Bochum, and I'm working in this system security group. And it's like stuff like privacy and cryptographic protocols and network data analysis and really large-scale systems, preferably. And, yeah, as you can see in the lower right-hand corner, this is kind of our outlook on the world. It's pretty dark there, but it's got double rainbows. So the topic is concerned with the time when oil becomes even more rare than it's now. And so we have a scarce resource here, and it will take some time until it runs out, but in the meantime it will be expensive, and probably too expensive for the average civilian to use it as propulsion technique. And so we've got several other propulsion techniques coming there. One of them is electric propulsion, and I think it will be most probably one resource that can be used or will be used. We will see it in the near future as urban transport for short and medium range, so up to 400 kilometers. And what happens in the longer run really depends on how battery technology develops and what people actually like about it, so market acceptance. Anyway, if you've got the possibility to try driving an electric car or electric motorcycle, you should really do, because acceleration is awesome. Try it in the city, try it at the red lights. Just go ahead. Basically, electric vehicles are not that new. It's not that known, I think, but around 1900, 38% of the cars in the US were electrics. So this was basically mostly rental cars, and it was very similar for most major cities in Europe, for example, in Berlin or in Hamburg or Paris, just probably 10 years later. So nowadays, or in the modern times, it was an enthusiast technology for the last 30 years. People have been retrofitting electric cars or combustion cars to electric cars for themselves, pretty successful. And nowadays, we are in the situation as many car manufacturers, that is the OEMs here, produce one or more electric cars or plan to do so in the next 2 years. So the one part of the talk, right, and the other part is privacy, especially location privacy. And it's been defined by Bloomberg and Eckersley very aptly as the ability of an individual to move in public space with the expectation that under normal circumstances, the location will not be systematically and secretly recorded for later use, so you can move without being observed. And then I thought, okay, privacy in the face of the recent use, just scrap it. Basically, it's probably gone, and So this is also what some of our reviewers actually think. They say people really problems with location privacy of credit card transactions because everybody pays with credit cards and so on. And given all these privacy breaches all around, especially in the context of we are here in the refueling business, what does anonymous payment provide? This guy made a very important point, unwittingly maybe, that he said the claim that users must have location privacy equivalent to cash on a gas pump seems like a very weak motivation, since most drivers pay with credit card anyway. And this is a very important part that I took the liberty to highlight the most here, because this is what it's all about. We've got even if we're a minority in a society that desires privacy, society, I think, has the duty to respect this. And right now we've got the freedom of choice in payment, and we should have this and we should retain this in a new technological context. So right now, when you pay for fuel, it's pretty easy. You can pay by card, of course, and about 2/3 of people in Germany do this, actually. But there's 1/3 that still does pay by cash. And what's cool about cash is that you've got the unlinkability of transactions, so that one payment is not linked to the other payment, and also your location is not bound to your identity when you by means of a payment. So your location remains private at the moment that you pay. And this is a very important thing, I think. And cash is very unique in this way of payment in all established forms of payment that we have currently. When you pay for energy, it looks a bit different. You typically have a formal contract. That is, you have a post-pay contract, you pay your bill at the end of the month or whatever. or you have prepaid contacts if you're kind of unfortunate. The implication of a contract is always that the vendor knows the customer. So we've got a vendor that knows your name, or probably more, actually. When you have a look at who builds charging infrastructure for electric vehicles, then it's not the oil guys. So it's all electric utility companies that own networks already, and that see this as a chance to move forward to the mobility market. So this is the example of Germany, but it's actually the same in most other countries in Europe and also in the US and Canada, that you've major players here and a lot of small players, and the small players typically unite and try to compete with the bigger guys. And the status, as you can gather it from the net, is in the US and Canada you have public charging stations of around 11,000 that are really publicly accessible, that are not on private property. In the European Union, the most reliable source, I'd say, is Lemnet here, but they have a very low estimate. So they say it's about 4,000. But you can see that it's low, that because we know, for example, in Netherlands, the Stichting Elat has 2,300 stations themselves alone. And Germany, RWE, has about 1,500. And so this goes up. It's a really low estimate. The European Commission has a very interesting minimum target set for 2020. They say they'd like to have something like 795,000 charging stations, public accessible charging stations. This is from the idea that there's almost, they say that we won't have a lot of electric cars, then we should have a lot of charging stations, because everybody needs one whenever he or she parks, then should charge. Infrastructure kind of looks like this. If you've never seen such a thing, it's a charging station you just plug in your car. And what you will not see on such a charging station typically is any way to insert coins, insert bills, anything. There's no way to pay cash. And this is actually a pretty important change. It's done for pragmatic reasons, mainly. But you're not going to have any chance of paying cash. So that means you always authenticate. That means you always leave a trace where you charge. And the reason for that is cash is kind of hard. When you've got conventional fuel stations, then it's kind of a centralized infrastructure. You've got a few pumps, and then you've got a cashier or a place where you deposit cash. And when you've got charging stations, they are more stretched out. So it's a distributed infrastructure. And the hard thing about this is maintaining a low cash level. If you don't maintain a low cash level, you encourage theft or at least vandalism. So, and if you want to maintain a low cash level in each of these charging stations, you have to invest a significant amount of money in doing so. So somebody has to go around and collect the cash. And as there are way easier ways to bill customers, then why should anybody go to the hassle and use cash here? So another thing about the infrastructure is, remember all the company logos a few slides back? Me neither, because actually I, as a customer, I don't care. I want to go to a charging station, I want to just charge there. I don't want to have a contract with any provider who owns charging stations. So what I want to have as a customer is seamless roaming. And the utilities have already understood that this is a nice thing. And they also want to have this, because it means that they don't have to build competing infrastructure for themselves, but they can have concentrate in one area and somebody else does another area, and every customer can charge at every owner's or every utility's charging station here. What this means on the back end is that we need a clearing infrastructure. This is probably known from telecommunication or from banking. So we've got need an infrastructure or a service that balances what the customer of utility A charges at, for example, the charging station of utility B, and vice versa. So this is additional infrastructure that is needed and that is currently being built. There are at least two competing efforts in Europe right now that do this or try to do this. The one is rather backed by small utilities. The other one is rather backed by the bigger guys. So we'll see. So in summary, infrastructure is being built by electric utility companies, not by oil companies. Cash is expensive to use, so it's hard. And so probably, well, most probably, we're not going to see this here. Right now, we don't see this here. And if you talk to people that work for utilities then or and are concerned with this topic, then we're not going to see cash here. We also have roaming. And this we should keep in mind. It's convenient, and it also enlarges the infrastructure. Also, utilities have a different billing model than oil companies. Oil is more rather pay-per-use. Utilities use postpaid or prepaid tariffs, and they have already billing infrastructure in place. This is something they invested in, and they send you a bill every month or whatever, and they're not going to replace this infrastructure because of what's expensive. And they are not really in favor of anonymous customers. So what do they gain from having anonymous customers? It's one you could argue at that point, but it doesn't lead very far. The next thing is that to keep in mind is that electric vehicles, or we're rather talking about cars here, right, will be charged whenever they are parked. And this has two reasons. And the one reason is that when you buy an electric car, then your supplier will tell you something like, always charge your car. Because the battery in the car is about one-third of the net worth of this car, so it's really expensive. And the battery knows basically two bad states, and the one is really simplified here. It's completely empty, and one is completely full. Completely full you can avoid by having proper battery management, and completely empty, the customer should charge. And the customer does this by her own free will because of this second point here. It's called range anxiety in the press typically. It means that although most electric vehicles have the capacity for your everyday needs, so the average German drives not more than 80 kilometers per day, and this is easily covered by current electric vehicles. The customer still fears not to reach their goal, to reach the target, and so the customer charges whenever he can. And this means, on the other hand, that the movement profile is much more precise than in the context when you use gas and you refuel every week or every month or whatever how much you drive. So you'll leave more traces here. And this means it doesn't really look nice for location privacy. But there are ways out, naturally. Of course, there's something that I said in the beginning, that electric vehicles have been an enthusiast technology for the last 30 years. And this means that there is community infrastructure. We could use something that's around in academia for quite some time. It's pretty nice in this context, untraceable electronic cash, not to be confused with something like Bitcoin. And we could also try to amend existing infrastructure. So community infrastructure, as I said, already exists. There is, for example, in Germany, there's Drehstromnetz, which is just means you join the network by putting such a wall-mounted box on a publicly accessible place. And for mounting this box, you get a key that fits all the other boxes. And you have got a map with coordinates where you can, so you know where you can charge. You can just drive up there and charge, and afterwards you leave the appropriate amount of money in this box. So it's a really fair use principle. It needs a lot of trust. As it is with communities, they typically work best when they're small, and you have outliers when they are bigger. So when the community size grows, we will see more abuse. And another problem is rather fascinating. Came up in a workshop with people from utilities and government and so on, and they said something. It's home charging is going to be a problem because when we replace electricity as a propulsion technique, or we use electricity as a propulsion technique in replacement for gas. Nowadays, when you build streets or maintain streets, this is to a significant percentage financed by gas tax. And this means that if this income at that point decreases, that every state or every country has to replace at this point. This means that we see something like taxation on electricity that is used for driving. The interesting point is here, if you charge your car at home at this point, you're kind of evading taxes. The way around, even the utilities see that this is a problem because you criminalize people and you shouldn't. So the idea is people want fast charging because people don't want to wait for 8 hours until their car is full. And so we just tax fast charging. And this means that you can't really do fast charging even if you have the technical capabilities at home. So you're kind of limited and locked in into slower charging techniques here. So second way or possible way out is, as I said, untraceable electronic cash. It's been a while. It's been around for a while. I think it started with the paper by Chom in 1988. And there have been a lot of publications on this here over the 90s and until recent days. And there's some pretty interesting work in the latter paper, actually, that solves a lot of problems in this context. So, but the interesting thing about this, it's been around since 1988, and none of us has ever seen this in the wild. This is because nobody wants untraceable electronic cash, actually. So none of the vendors wants it. I, as a consumer, I would approve. But as a vendor, maybe not. And I'll just give you an intuition on the techniques itself. So keep in mind, intuition it means it's almost always nearly wrong. And so the originally e-cash was, or electronic cash was based on the principle of blind signatures. And just imagine you have envelopes made of carbon paper, so everything you write on it prints through on the inside. And then a user generates coin and notes, and these coins and notes have a serial number, and the user puts these coins in an envelope and hands it to the bank. The bank signs the envelope, and because it's carbon paper, the signature of the bank prints through on the notes. So this means that the content is signed, but the signer actually has never seen the content. That's because it's the reason why it's called blind. Then the user is free to use this money and can use it to pay any vendor that accepts it. And the vendor hands the coin back to the bank. And the bank then checks, has this coin already been used? It looks up in the big database and the growing database. This is one of the problems here in practical use. The database only knows one direction of growth because with every coin that's generated, when it's redeemed, the bank stores this serial number of the coin in the database. So this is the intuition of that, and it's actually, from a privacy perspective, as a technique, it's awesome. It really solves a lot of problems here because it's really near the point of having actual cash without the hassles of maintaining low cash levels and so on. The problem here is basically started early with people saying that it facilitates crime. So there was this the first paper on untraceable electronic cash was in 1988. 1992, there was on blind signatures and perfect crimes because it's untraceable. And this is basically a problem that every government has with untraceable cash. And it's also that, keep in mind that most utilities still are unwilling to serve anonymous customers. So if the vendor does not want your currency, what can you do? So the third way out or possible way out would be to improve our existing infrastructure, make it privacy friendly. So right now we have a limited amount of infrastructure. Say we've got 10,000, 11,000 in the US, say we've got 10,000 charging stations in Europe. The back end is typically organically grown, so with some cases I know this is hulking giant of Tomcat Java code that has been grown over years and is almost unmaintainable right now. So it doesn't hurt to rewrite the stuff at the moment. And they still need to figure out clearing, and they still need to figure out some other pretty interesting stuff as billing customers by the energy consumed, actually, and not just selling parking tickets, back, which is what they are doing right now, at least most of them. So the infrastructure is still pretty large scale. It's still a lot of effort here. And you need to think in context of national or European size, because we're roaming and clearing, probably at least continent-wise. You need to be compliant with existing billing infrastructure, and it should at least offer some incentives for the vendor, not only for us as a customer. So the authentication of having a using current infrastructure that fits to current billing infrastructure, that means that we need authentication, that we still need something that where the customer is actually known. So we need to ensure that we have non-reputability of the identity of the customer if we want to bill them. And in the context of user authentication, this means that the user must provide authentication to the charging station right now before it starts charging, sometimes even before he can plug the cable that is used for charging. And we can then reuse this authentic credentials for billing. For billing, we do something which is actually pretty simple. We just use something to cryptographically bind the user ID and the freshness parameter, like timestamp, and the consumed energy, and then we send this off to the clearinghouse. Current authentication methods that are out there are being developed. It's of course smartphone apps, which basically means that you have an app that contains a QR code reader. And there's a QR code at the charging station. You scan this code, and it communicates with the back end saying, "Okay, I'm customer X. I'm at charging station Y. Please unlock this and let me start charging." The same can be done by a phone call and also by SMS. SMS to charge is actually one of the most used techniques right now, next to smart cards, or rather not so smart cards. Most cards in the market right now are MyFair Classics, and I think we should have learned some lessons on MyFair Classics by now. But they're still being used because they're cheap and everybody knows them. And of course, you can use other smart tokens like NFC-enabled phone that have basically the same functionality here. And what the OEMs, that is the car manufacturers, really like in this context is the ISO standard 15118. It basically means it's marketed as plug and charge, that you just plug in your electric vehicle to the charging station and then seamlessly start charging. This works basically by having a smart card in the car and having a communication protocol in the charging cable. So it's pretty nice, but has some interesting legal implications, because typically you have a driver and you have a car owner, and this is not necessarily the same person, but who are you going to have the contract with? So this is currently unsolved on the legal side. So, location privacy in this context. If the user must be identifiable, why can't we just have the charging station anonymous? In real life, we don't need to know where this charging process took place to bill the customer. And we can actually do this with the help of not signing the credentials with standard signature algorithms, but using group signatures here. The following is joint work with Sven Schäge, Martin Goll, and Thorsten Holz. And let me just introduce you to group signatures on a very superficial level. Group signatures are still a digital signature scheme with the additive that it brings strong sender anonymity. So the signature is not produced on behalf of an individual, but on behalf of a group. So a verifier can check, is this a valid signature on this data from a group member? But it's not able to attribute the signature to an actual group member, but just to any group member. And it also brings something that's very important in this context. It brings us unlinkability. So if we'd have just pseudonyms in this context, you could also link the processes towards each other. And unlinkability allows for not linking the individual signing processes. So keep in mind, this is not the authentication for the user, but the charging station signs here and sends something off to the back end. So what do we need in this context for this to work? We've got two trusted third parties, kind of. The one is the group manager, and the other is called the opener. When we verify a signature, it's not verified against the user public key, UK, but against a group public key. And the group public key is generated, held, and updated by this trusted third party that we call the group manager. And the group manager issues credentials, which you can imagine as something like certificates in a conventional public key infrastructure, but they hide the user's identity. And he also maintains information on revoked credentials. So if you kick an entity here, a charging station, out of the group, you have to maintain a revocation list or something similar to that. Then we have an opener, and we don't have an equivalent to the opener in classical PKIs. The opener holds a secret key for the revocation of signer anonymity. So the opener can undo what we've been achieving so far, that means sender anonymity. This means the opener really has to be trusted. We imagine in this context a notary or an entity that is really bound by law to act this way. You see, I'm talking about a lot of law or legal in this context. This doesn't stand alone. This is nice technology, but it will not help you if there's not a legal context that enables this technology. To join a group, each user creates a credential, and this credential contains a commitment. This commitment is only is public, but the only the user knows the decommitment. So the decommitment here is the user's secret key. On the group join, the group manager doesn't sign the credential or the certificate in classical PKIs, but just signs the commitment. So we move the trust from the public key to the commitment, and what we gain by that is that the identity of the user that is typically contained in a certificate is not known, but we know that it's provable. When we generate signatures, then we have signatures that contain of two parts. Part one is a probabilistic encryption of this credential, of the actual credential that would reveal our identity, and we encrypt this to the opener. So this is part one of the signature. And the other is a message dependent, so this is the actual integrity serving part here. It's message dependent, non-interactive proof that the user knows a wallet C that corresponds with his or her secret key with respect to the group public key, and also the proof that the C that we're talking about here is the same that we just encrypted to the opener, because if it wasn't, the opener would open this encryption at some point, and there would be a different C, and so this would allow for framing any other user in this context. So we could use any charging station to generate payment tokens of any other charging stations in the group. So the part B is a non-interactive zero-knowledge proof. So this means that we don't reveal any information on the signer, on the generator of this proof, beyond the validity of this proof. So when everybody knows or can verify that this proof is valid, but it doesn't reveal any identity here beyond the group. So verification works just like that. The receiver of our group signature here, this is typically the backend at the clearinghouse, or any utility can check the whether this proof checks out with respect to the group public key. So this is just as in conventional public key schemes. So if successful, we have obtained a proof that the message was unaltered. This is important. This is it means the billing token is correct. You can bill the customer with that. And you is a valid member of the group, so this is not just anyone, but it's really a charging station. And the opener is really able to reveal the signer identity. So we've seen the opener a few times here. And more than that in a few minutes, or a few seconds actually. This is our infrastructure. We've got customers that can that are customers to any utility, that can use charging stations of any other utility, and in the end we just send off this data to the backend, our clearinghouse here, and the clearinghouse basically distributes the billing relevant data to the individual utilities and balances the accounts. So, the opener, why do we have them? As you can see, or as you have probably so far seen that the opener is a trade-off. The scheme for me as a customer would be way more convenient if there wouldn't be an opener, so then nobody could ever reveal the location where my charting process took place. And this is clearly a trade-off, as I said. It's we like to offer legitimate dispute resolution here. That means that we've got utilities here that have we want to use this technology. And these guys are used to settle any disputes in front of a court of law. And this means that if we've got our technique here and we want to have them compliant with the current business processes as best as possible, then we have to offer something similar. And also there is something very interesting, and this interesting part is energy and standards and measurements laws. Almost every country has these. And in Germany, for example, when you sell energy to someone and you bill this person for the energy, then you're required to show the meter ID, and you have to retain, for every measurement you do, you have to retain the meter ID for 6 months. And the problem with the meter ID, Deutsche Zählernummer, is it's a location-bound token. So if we need to retain this, then basically everything we did before is futile. But we can amend this problem by encrypting this all location-bound tokens that we probably need in the part where we encrypt the credential to the opener anyway. So we still reduce the amount of trust we have in the system, or we need to have in the system, to one entity. Also, this is why we have the opener here. The scheme that we're using is XSGS. It's extremely small group signatures. We use it because it's pretty fast, and it you can sign on an Armoury 8 of the gigahertz in about 41 milliseconds. Time is not really critical here because we typically have a charging process, one signature per charging process, and a charging process takes something like at least 30 minutes if there's not a problem during the process. And why the RMA 8 core here? It's something that you can actually find on charging stations out there. So it's, it could work. Then the verification is also pretty cheap. We can verify 93 messages per second on a single Intel Xeon core. So this is, you can easily parallelize this. And what's nice about XGS is that you can do batch verification where you do the really expensive computations only once per batch. And what's also nice and what's really important here is XGS offers non-frameability. As I said before, it fulfills the need for unlinkability of the signatures. So even if we have one signature opened, we don't know which other, so right now unopened signatures have been signed by the same signer. This is a pretty nifty feature here. And also it's provably secure in a very strong security model, the BSSet model. This is nice from an academic point of view, but also it's also nice in practicality because it's in praxis it's pretty secure. It's based on the BBS scheme, so if you want to read up the math here, and the XGS scheme itself is published by De La Rablé and Pocheval at Wirtcrypt in 2006. So if you want to have all the formulas that I've not shown here, you best read them up there. So back to our context here. What our group signature schemes offers, if we use it here, is a cryptographic binding of metering data and freshness token at the user ID. So we can create a billing token that's or a metering datum that's sufficient for billing. The identity of the charging station remains hidden, and we only know the group association. So how cool this is with respect to privacy or location privacy really depends on the size of the group. We get a signature that's verifiable and that's not reputable, so this is from a legal point of view, this is nice because it should check out in court. And if we choose the group large enough, say all charging stations that are operated by utilities that are associated themselves with a certain clearinghouse, this is a pretty large group. So this we're thinking in categories here of all charging stations in Germany or all charging stations in Europe, all charging stations in the US or North America. This will, the size of the group depends actually on the convenience you have, that is how far your roaming goes. So far this is nice, right? But let's have a look at the network layer, because right now we can have a signature technique that keeps the identity and this the location of the charging station private, but then we transmit this data over the network, and we need something like sender anonymity here. Luckily for us, when sender anonymity should ring a bell here, everybody has heard of Tor, I guess, so it just solves this problem for us. So we can have this complete system overview looking like this, that the customer authenticates at the charging station, charges her car, and once the car is charged or the charging is interrupted for any reason, we generate a billing token. Then we build a tunnel from the charging station to the clearinghouse, and this tunnel we do build it to through Tor. So actually the clearinghouse has at least a lot of problems finding out the charging station that just sent this data. This is so far the system, and let me conclude here with saying that location privacy for electric vehicle charging is feasible. We've seen at least three ways where how you can achieve this, how you can retain the privacy that you currently have with just paying cash at the gas station in this technological context that we're all, let's face it, going to see in the next 5 or 10 years. We've got the community approach. We can try to roll all our own infrastructure here, which is really, really hard because it's really hard for the utilities, and the utilities have a lot of resources, and we're talking here about coverage of charging stations out there in a density that makes sense to the customer that's actually usable. Or we can try to patch the existing beginnings, and what we resorted to was trying to build a system that can be integrated into current infrastructure with not too much hassle, so to say. Computing, as I said, computing is hard, so we should try to improve the current system, I think. This would be beneficial for customers, and it would also be beneficial for a clearinghouse and the utilities. How so? On the one hand, you can evade data loss scandals. So data that is not there, that you don't own, can't be lost to Pastebin. On the other hand, is we have a unique selling point here, because what most utilities are struggling right now with is to be compliant with energy and standard laws, to really bill the customer by the kilowatt hours that the customer consumed. So what they're really doing right now is just selling parking slots at the moment. And our system, at least our legal department tells us, is most compliant. Full compliance is indisputable here for any system right now, because the laws we have are not really fit for the scenario right now. So what we see from that is privacy-friendly solutions really need a political will and a lobby. So it's nice to have technology there, but technology is not going to solve the problem itself, but this, if the topic is not on an agenda. Also, as every other approach, our approach requires new legislation. At least we would need to protect the opening phrase, because the opener could really reveal everything and just make the whole approach or the whole attempt to protect location privacy futile here. We really need to protect the opening phase. There's a technical report on that, so if you want to read all the technical details that I've left out, the QR code should lead you to the PDF. We've got also some code on that, at least our implementation of the XGS scheme we should be able to release. The other is part of a project, so we're not sure which parts of code we actually will be able to release, but we're trying to release as much as possible. And right now we're trying to integrate the system into a reference architecture to just show in the context of a project that this can actually work, this does actually make sense in this context. At least I hope so. And now I'll take your questions, and if you have questions later, there's my Twitter handle under there. Look, and this is my mail address, just drop me a line.
I want to take a question about the premise.
Yeah. So the question is, I just repeat or rephrase because there's no mic. The question was, why would we just focus on electric mobility and why would we just don't use this scheme for every other payment scenario that there that is out there, right? We don't actually. This is just the example that we choose. And I'm pretty aware that this would fit many other problem spaces as well. So as you say, refueling conventional cars, same problem here. You pay by card, same problem. You could fit this on other domains here. I just chose this problem domain. You can adapt to others. I don't know which was first, actually.
I think there's and one option that you didn't look at, and that is because we are in a physical transaction mode, and the two parties of the transaction are actually both present one way or other, physically present. So you're physically present. So a simple anonymous cash voucher or an anonymous debit card would solve the problem as well, and that can be implemented relatively easily and safely,
kind
and
of.
Would work across with traditional filling stations as
yeah.
well.
It would solve kind of, because it would also only solve the problem if you use the prepaid or debit card or whatever only for one transaction, because if you don't, you link your transactions. And this is a problem because we have learned, there was a nice article in Science, I think, a few months back, that from only four transactions of a pseudonymous person, you can say with 95% probability who this person actually was in this data set. So pseudonymity is not enough here. But you can, of course, pay for a voucher, deposit, discard this voucher afterwards, then you would solve the same problem.
You're right, but as it is an anonymous card, of course, there's no limit how many of those you have in your pocket. And then when you use it for
yeah.
five transactions, then yeah. it's expired, you take a new one, and you have
yeah,
also limited it quite
the,
a bit.
The problem here is then still that even if we just say anonymous vouchers that you can buy from a utility, they say no. So this is my experience in talking to them. That's a problem here.
Yeah, your approach presupposes the private property of cars. And, well, is that still interesting? Because, well, you see in big cities, and electric cars work mainly in big cities, the number of privately owned cars decreases, especially in Berlin. And I think the way of the future is that cars are simply there. You use them and leave them at some place, because there's always the problem with parking places in big cities. This increases with these stations. You have to find a place for them. So owning a car seems to me a concept of the past. So if it is a concept of the past, it would be much better to link the payment to the car and not to a person. Because well, then the company that owns the car and rents the car, then you well then they will provide electricity, and the customer just pays for the car, including the electricity.
Yeah, sure. It's okay. It's, I think it's a rather philosophical question on whether you should own cars or not.
No, it's a fact. It's empirically
okay.
It's empirically proved that the owning of cars is decreasing is decreasing in big cities.
Yes.
So that is a fact.
Okay.
Just to add, in Paris you have exactly that model. So you have electric cars and you have car sharing models with electric cars. So it's what you're saying.
Yeah. So actually, no critique from me here. I think that's the good idea. And it's, but still, you have a significant percentage of population that owns cars. And I think you're not going to lose this populace entirely. And then we are back at the point that also minorities have rights and need to be protected. So, yeah, when this minority then is car owners, then so be it. I think it's still fair, I guess. And, of course, you could also transfer this whole system to paying by car. It's just where you place the credential. right? So it's also still the point is only where you place the authentication point and whether you profile cars with a set of users. And would be interesting to do data mining on this data set, actually. But still, yeah. I mean, the system basically would be compatible. Could stretch it out to that. And the future will show how this car ownership in Germany or in Europe or in the world is going to develop.
Yeah, so one more question from Pierre on your other side.
Hi.
And so I wanted to ask, do you really think this will matter to the customer? I think a lot of people are already giving freely away their location with their cell phone 24 hours a day, and I think just some small data points will not matter to them anymore.
Yep, that's true, but the point is that you can leave your cell phone at home, and if your car is the your mean of transport that brings you... At
yeah, but you still have public transportation where you do not get tracked.
In cities, correctly. Don't have public transportation everywhere, and actually it's a freedom of choice not to use public transportation and still want to have something like location privacy. So I think, yes, should be still interesting.
Yeah, one small remark on the last part about public transport and not being tracked. In the Netherlands, it is the case that you are being tracked in public transport, so every train and every tram movement is just being copied into a database. Not necessarily being tied to an individual, but of course the public transport sector does everything to make you buy a card which is on your name, tied to your identity. So maybe in Germany it's different or still different, I don't know, but in the Netherlands it's fucked up.
Yeah, so... when it comes to public transport, actually, the last paper down there is pretty interesting because it actually tackles the exact problem here, at least tries to. It's, again, nice use of theory, and it's pretty well thought out, and it's a pretty nice paper. If you can put it to use to convince any mobility provider of public transport means to use such schemes... So it's basically on the idea that you have a card and you check in and you, when you enter the means of transport, then you check out again. So and this exactly fits the scheme or tries to solve this privacy problem here. Further questions? Then thanks for your time. Or
If we can talk shortly about the paying process, you said you want to send messages about Tor. Is Tor reliable enough?
Yeah, basically.
Guaranteed?
Guaranteed, of course not, but it's not time critical here. So even if you should see network outages here, then you just retain the payment tuple. Data tuple at the charging station, and when the network is back up, you just send it. So reliability, it's really not time critical because you only have a certain amount of transactions per day. Because charging, charging takes at least right now half an hour. This is Tesla's fast charging stations. Normal charging stations you see out here are way slower. So time is not an issue at that point.
But as you said, this is only an example. Most paying transactions are time critical, very time critical, and there are many regulations about that. Mm-hmm. So I don't think Tor is any option if you want to make it real.
Okay. Okay, thanks again.